This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
To change it.
We have to leave it there, but we certainly won't. We'll continue to cover this story. Josh Idelson, thank you so much as well. To our guest in Kansas City, to Terrence Wise. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is 8 a.m. Stay tuned next for Positively Revolting Talk Radio. This morning, Ani and Lynn will speak with Shane about building revolutionary anarchism and take your calls coming up next, right after these announcements.
Do you love listening to KBOO? Want to get involved in the great programming you hear? Become a volunteer. KBOO's volunteer orientation will be Tuesday, August 6th at 6 p.m., located at Southeast 8th and Ankeny in Portland. Questions can be directed to Ani at 503-231-8032, extension 213, or by email at volunteer@kboo.org.
The first annual Jim Pepper Native Arts Festival will take place Wednesday, August 7th and Saturday, August 10th at Park Rose High School Performing Arts Center, 12003 Northeast Shaver Street, Portland. Jim Pepper was born in Salem, Oregon and lived in the Portland area for many years. A jazz saxophone composer and singer of Native American ancestry, he became a pioneer of fusion jazz in the late 1960s. This event is sponsored by KBOO Community Radio and the Oregon Cultural Heritage Commission. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. That is our engineer, Mike. This is Lynn. I'm here with Ani, and you are listening to
Positively Revolting Talk Radio at KBOO, your own community broadcasting station, progressive talk radio for over 20 years now, every 5 days a week. 5 days a week.
We count them.
Count them.
So, and welcome to it. We are here this morning to talk about many things that revolve around anarchism and organizing and anarchist organization. We're going to be doing that with Shane. Good morning, Shane.
Good morning.
And wonderfully, Shane has agreed to be with us this morning to further this discussion. He's one of the co-founders of Rochester Red and Black, also active in the housing justice movement, working with Take Back the Land and other groups, also the local group Housing is for Everyone, which, of course, you've heard from other folks from Housing is for Everyone here on Positively Revolting just a few months ago.
Wait, Housing is for Everyone?
It's a wacky concept, isn't it, Lynn?
Oh, man.
Housing, everyone. Yes. And also, Shane has recently finished making a documentary on the housing justice movement called Expect Resistance. So thank you very much for taking some time and helping to discuss these issues.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Our pleasure.
Lynn, you had a little something to start us off.
One of the things we're going to do first is define anarchism, because it's something that makes people run, some folks run for the hills. Look out, look out. The anarchists are coming. But Howard Zinn, a very respected historian in most circles, said, and I quote, "I am an anarchist, and according to anarchist principles, nation states become obstacles to a true human globalization. In a certain sense, the movement towards globalization, where capitalists are trying to leap over nation state barriers, creates a kind of opportunity for movement to ignore national barriers and to bring people together globally across nation lines. The opposition to globalization of capital to created globalization of people opposed to the traditional notion of globalization." That would be a pretty nice definition. Well, we can go on and on from there.
We can. And let's.
Okay.
Otherwise, the show's very short.
I know.
Okay. So let's also have maybe how you want to use the term, Shane. I think it's always good, as we talk about anarchism, because it is so misused, it is understood differently by different people, it's used differently by different people, and anarchism, anarchy, anarchist are all very broad labels that cover a huge and diverse movement. So let's start with how we're using terms. I love Howard Zinn's definitions. That's nice. Always nice to have framing from Howard. How do you use anarchism?
Well, I think you're right about the misconception, but to have a misconception, they have to even have a conception at all to begin with, which is usually lost. You know, either maybe it means informed chaos of some sort, or even at worst, it might mean Ron Paul, which it absolutely does not.
Sorry, if you get me all laughing in the morning.
But the simplest way to look at it is either an opposition to all forms of hierarchy, whether or not that is the hierarchy and inequality inherent in capitalism and the state, or it's the kind of hierarchy that we have in heterosexism, that we have in various forms of patriarchy, racism, homophobia. An opposition to that, a comprehensive opposition to that, where we see that these different struggles are intersecting, that would be kind of be the core of anarchism. Politically, it simply means the libertarian socialist movement, whereby capitalism and the state are
optimum. You might want to give that last line one more time, because there was a little technical faux pas that was happening even as you spoke.
Okay, so I mean, as a political program, I mean, that would really mean a libertarian communism, libertarian socialism, you know, an opposition to capitalism, an opposition to the state, an authoritarian state that essentially institutionalizes violence. And we see that if you live in a world and you see violence as abhorrent, you are anti-violence, you don't want to engage in institutional violence, whereby the exact existence of it is predicated on violence. So you see, instead, we want a world where the governing comes from the self, from the community, comes from the direct democracy, rather than an electoral democracy or kind of a representative democracy where you hope that you vote for someone and they go and, you know, represent your interests.
And you hope that they represent your interests, right?
Right. And when very obviously that the state is formed to protect capital. I mean, that's the very function of it. That's the basis on which private property and law is founded. So,
And boy, howdy, is that evident these days. It gets to be more and more evident all the time, in case people were wondering.
In case, just in case. You know, as I've identified as an anarchist for, I don't know, since I was about 20, I think. And so we'll call that, you know, 27 years. And in my experience of working with different anarchist groups and working within various movements, working not in an anarchist organization and coming forth in my true confessional moments, I have noticed in that 27-year span huge change, huge shifts in how anarchism is perceived. From, you know, 20 years ago plus, there was sort of this general mystification, you know, mouths dropped open, you know, why don't you just tell me you're a green fairy from Pluto next, you know, there was a little disbelief.
Well, you are that too.
Not so, you know, yeah, I'm bigger than most fairies and I'm not from Pluto. But it's one of those things where it was so anathema to political organizing and political identification in this area and really, you know, throughout the states in the 80s and early 90s. And over time, again, you know, as people kept at it, sharing our story, sharing our information, sharing our philosophies about why, in fact, we feel that the state is legitimized violence. How these things, you know, the opposition to hierarchy in social standing, for example, in racism or gender inequalities, how all of these things are at the heart of what we're trying to change, what we're trying to turn over. And that slowly over the years, I have watched it get some more legitimization, especially in the face of the Occupy movement, where suddenly, you know, people were conversing across the country and a large section of us identified as anarchists. I think that had some really positive impact that can last past the initial camping and whatnotting of Occupy into continuing dialogue, which is actually what we're doing here this morning and what this event coming up is that we're going to talk about in just a moment. Any feedback on that? Any comment on how you've watched perception evolve over some time?
Well, right. I mean, Occupy isn't a bunch of Trotskyists, you know. I think what happens is that when you watch the history of failed revolutions happen, people want something new. You know, there was a lot of hope, I guess, you know, in the early part of the 20th century on the left to want to support Russia, seeing as that maybe that was the only anti-capitalist revolution that could ever have happened. And when the Bolsheviks came to power in 1917, lots of anarchists and people really across the left-wing spectrum or the revolutionary spectrum jumped to support them. And within a few years were validated on how terrible it was. I mean, it's just, I mean, nearly immediately. And then obviously, I mean, becomes this awful bureaucratic state and takes on the worst features of state and capitalism. Mm-hmm. But what happens with anarchism is that because there are elements about it that are undefined, it has the ability to adapt to changing circumstances. And when people come in to something like Occupy, and the foundation of it is strictly trying to find something new. I mean, they come in most of the time, a lot of people being not used to organizing. And not used to having a political discourse, specifically an ideological discourse, and they come in and they're trying to reinvent democracy, reinvent the idea of self-government. And therefore, you come to essentially immediately anarchist principles within that context. Now, functionally, in terms of how things are organized, people have all sorts of differences. You know, I have tons of differences, and I have a very specific kind of anarchism that I think about. But I think anarchism will always remain at that edge where people are trying to confront the failures of the past. You know, and when the Berlin Wall comes down, it's the final nail in the coffin of the old bureaucratic left. There has to be something new. You know, people in, you know, revolutionary activities of the future are not looking to Cuba. They're not going to look to China and at these things as any form of what they want to see. These are not models for the future in any way. And the only model for the future they tend to have is something organic and new. You know, the model that they have for the future is each other. So
Let's talk about this conversation and moving things forward in that way. We have coming up on the 13th at the Red and Black here in Portland, a discussion that is about building a revolutionary anarchism. And this is a part of a nationwide sort of discussion that's been happening for a little while. And you're involved with that. And this is sort of the on-air discussion prior to the in-person discussion, as people can come and talk face-to-face and hear from Colin, whose last name is escaping me at the moment, Colin O'Malley, who will be traveling and has been on this little speaking tour across the country. He'll be speaking on the 13th at the Red and Black. You'll be introducing him and working with that discussion. What is the idea behind first of all, speaking tours, not so common these days. And so,
why do a speaking tour? I can go on the internet.
Right, there's a chat room for that, isn't there?
There is the YouTube.
So what's up with trying to get these discussions happening across the country? What is this about?
Right, I know personally from knowing Colin that one of the things that he tries to do on a regular basis is cut through the social mediaification of organizing, which is that people live through avatars and think that's organizing. And that's not even to be critical of folks. I mean, if I was new to something, I would think that making an event on Facebook was organizing too. And so the idea is that, like, especially when we're talking about anarchism, we're talking about direct democracy. We want people directly involved, directly coming together, and actually engaging in things. And if we want to have active local organization, people have to come and meet each other and know each other and find ways of working together. And that only happens in person. And
trust only happens in person.
Right. And he wanted to make a cross-country trip, and this was a really good excuse. I think he was thinking, well, I'll stop a couple places. And so he put out a request form, I think 18 locations, mm-hmm. signed him up immediately. So it became an endurance test rather than his casual vacation to see the West Coast.
That's great, though, to have that kind of response. And again, it to me indicates that there's a real thirst for this kind of connectivity, for this kind of discussion. For so long, again, just prior to Occupy, I would notice people were really thirsty. It was like, wow, I've never been able to talk about this with anyone, you know. And now we can, but we need the place, we need the space, we need the time. And I think that that's a very exciting thing to do. I want to remind our listeners that it's about 17 minutes after 8 o'clock in the morning. You are listening to KBOO, your very own community radio station. I'm Ani. I'm here with Lynn, and we have with us Shane. We're talking about anarchism, anarchist organizing, anarchist organizations, and all related such. I want to remind people, you can follow along throughout the week in a social network kind of way, as we do have a Facebook Positively Revolting page. You can find us there, you can like us there, and you can be a part of the conversation all week, as other people have. Mm-hmm. We are growing, I have to say. So please do like us on Facebook if you do such things, facebook.com/positivelyrevolting. You can also find us at Gmail and write in questions or comments during the show if you'd prefer that to our Gmail account, which is positivelyrevolting@gmail.com. Of course, you can call our studio, and this is a talk radio show, so please do call in and join us this morning. 503-231-8187 is the number to call if you'd like to be on the air.
An excellent thing to do. So this is happening now. Did we go through the dates of when this is happening?
August 13th here locally.
Okay. Is there a good, speaking of social media, is there a good website for people to check you out at? For this?
Yes. RockRedAndBlack.org. So that's ROC RedAndBlack.org. And you can also Google search Rochester Red and Black. I usually find all those sorts of things are easier. That's the base website for the organization. And there's, you know, I would also check the Red and Black Cafe website because the event will be on there. And a number of other groups are kind of sharing around, like the Institute for Anarchist Studies and the IWW and things like that.
All right. You know, also, it's a little, you have made a film. We were just talking about that before the show. So I'd love to hear a little bit about that. That sounded incredibly interesting.
Right. So I made a documentary that's going to film festivals now. It has film festival premiere pretty soon. Looking mainly at Take Back the Land, Rochester, and how it began to grow and merge with Occupy, and kind of the idea of approaching housing from the point of direct action, that being the foundation of how you'd both affect immediate struggles and how you would diagram struggles of the future, how you would want to transform the neighborhood through struggle into existing something new. And so we follow a few people going through foreclosure, them deciding to stay in their houses, to fight the foreclosure, to do what it takes through confrontation and that kind of thing. And then what that means for developing kind of modes of solidarity, connections between the community, and how successful it ends up being.
Well, you know, one of the things people talk about in movement stuff is struggle, and you know what that means. But sometimes listeners don't get exactly, they're like, struggle? What exactly does that sort of thing entail? Like, what does it's something that people, like I said, in movements start using and then assume like some acronym that everybody knows what that means. So I'd love to sort of unpack that a little bit.
Right. I mean, in a world where there's intersecting oppressions, I mean, there's various ways in which people don't have access to the same resources, don't have access to the same social capital. They don't have. And there's not an equal playing field, we'll say.
You could say that.
And in that, obvious enough. But in that, instead of trying to go around these things, which are kind of embedded in society, it's about confronting them and trying to challenge those things. And so a struggle is essentially trying to overcome this adversity. And we find this interpersonally in our lives a lot, but we find it collectively in social struggles, whether or not it's LGBT struggles for just basic civil rights, or at least to even be acknowledged by society. The struggles in housing, for example, to not be at the unjust whim of banks, completely unaccountable, just tearing through our neighborhoods. And so collectively, that struggle is to fight back, to defend yourself, to then change the rules of the game. If we're losing at the game, we're not just going to compete and win. We have to literally change the foundations of it, the system itself. So the struggle in housing is to basically take it away from capital and create community control over land and housing, to have a directly democratic sort of control. And that happens only by resisting those issues when they come up and using it to create a new model.
So people tend to be generally fearful of banks. So how do they exactly? We've had some folks on here before in the who have worked on taking back their houses, their homes, not just houses, their homes. Mm-hmm. And so what I'm interested in some particular stories that mm-hmm. happened with your film. That because
right.
part of that to me is the stories. People need to have different stories besides the bank came in and took my home. Mm-hmm. We need to have different stories to put in our collective subconscious.
I mean, the what I like to say is they went on strike. What happens is, one story I think is central is the story of this man, Leonard Spears. And Leonard had bought a house that was condemned, and he had fixed it up from the ground up. It was always his dream to own a house. And in Rochester, I think it should be noted that there are some neighborhoods there that have an 85% unemployment rate. This is kind of like a small Detroit. So home ownership there, unlike some other places, he bought a house for, I think, $8,000. It's not like maybe buying a house in the suburbs here. So he worked, built this house himself, and got injured on the job and had, the gap time it usually takes to get on or to get a disability. Mm-hmm. It was often times like a year or so. So he tried to work out with the banks to be like, I can absolutely pay my payments. I just need to get on this new financial plan. Of course, that wasn't going to happen, because banks use this as an opportunity to push their foreclosure. I mean, it's blatantly happens every time. So of course they foreclose on that kind of thing. And he doesn't know what else to do. He starts moving out his stuff. So we go door to door. I mean, the foundation of Take Back the Land is canvassing. So what we do is look up who's going through foreclosure in a neighborhood, go talk to them and try and link them up. And the idea of creating kind of these neighborhood bonds where people can protect each other and also just be open with each other because of how alienating something like that can be.
Oh,
and
the especially shame that goes along with that in America. It's just...
And for something that in a lot of these cases literally has nothing to do with a person's qualities
absolutely.
Or anything they've ever done. So Leonard, I mean, at that point, you know, like, do you want to stay in your home? And he's like, absolutely. And I was like, well, then let's just say now you're going to stay in your home, you know, and that's what he wanted to do. So we started by petitioning his neighborhood, getting up signatures, and then going to Wells Fargo to the location to deliver them. Of course, mm-hmm. Wells Fargo shuts down the bank.
They were happy to see you.
They were so happy that they wouldn't let any of us in. And then so we, you know, diverted and had one other group of people storm the mortgage division. So the next day, Wells Fargo, who wouldn't even speak to him at this point, called and said, well, it's about 50-50 chance you'll get your house back. Of course, given a long enough period of time, they don't. You know, he goes to court. They, you know, bring some attorneys in. You know, this document wasn't signed. They had his proof of foreclosure, you know, the note to come mm-hmm. contest it in court, he never received, which is a really common story. Mm-hmm. He's probably about 5'6", 5'7", has alopecia, so he has no hair, but I believe the note said he was about 6'2" and had blonde hair. So he has to have evidence that this person was actually physically handed this. You know, mm-hmm. it's very important that they know this because it's a legal document. So it was very obviously forged. I mean, it was, you know, there's no indication that they'd ever met this man. None of that mattered in court.
Right.
So the story there is kind of that he continues to stay and that they have to decide whether or not they want to come after what is now a public figure mm-hmm. and forcibly remove them from their home. Another story, and the one that's really that's been going on for a long time, is this woman, Catherine Lennon, and her family. Now, there's 11 people living in the house, her children, their children. And her husband had died of brain and lung cancer, and she had never had standing on the house. It didn't transfer with the estate, and so they wouldn't take her payments. And so they foreclosed, even though she was offering the money, and forcibly removed them with the police. You know, came mm-hmm. in with SWAT teams, I think about 15 cop cars, and forcibly removed them. So, you know, a week later or so, we moved her back into her house, and she's never left at that point. And, you know, under threat that we would physically defend it again, blockade the mm-hmm. front of the house, they negotiated and gave her house back.
Shane, I'm going to jump in for a moment and just say, so this is anarchist organizing. You know, this is one way of looking at how some people are choosing to resolve some of these issues, right? Keeping people in our homes, keeping our neighbors safe and in our communities, it's such a human thing, right? And it seems like it's, you know, really to the good, right? And yet this image of anarchists being, you know, crazy, nihilistic, bomb-throwing maniacs who really don't care about, you know, neighbors or regular folk that have jobs. You know, anarchists don't have jobs. They don't care about folks with jobs. And, you know, and all of these things that are sort of hurled, you know, in the anarchist direction, generally propagated by the media, you know, and then picked up by people who don't know any better and who've never perhaps met somebody who identifies.
Though at times propagated by ourselves, I'm sure.
At times, God knows.
Full disclosure.
But, you know, that it seems to me that this kind of direct community work is one of the best ways to demonstrate as well as educate, you know, people on what basic anarchist organizing principles are.
There's a common sense element to it. The other thing that we did in Take Back the Land, and I think this is, I guess, more striking for a lot of folks, is that we find empty bank-owned homes that have been emptied through foreclosure, and we move homeless families into them. And when people hear that, it just seems like the most obvious thing that could have ever been presented. Well, there's a growing number of homeless folks, especially homeless families. These are empty houses, oftentimes in good condition. If there's not a person in them, they fall apart almost immediately, especially in Rochester. I mean, 2 days of an empty house, yeah. the copper would be gone. It would just immediately. I mean, like the houses would fall apart. You move a homeless family into them, and it's just the most common sense thing there could possibly be. And I think working on that common sense level shows people what the power of acting directly can do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not appealing to benevolent rulers that are going to, hopefully take care of us in the end. It's about finding the methods to take care of ourselves that are actually effective and actually transform things.
And not waiting for Big Daddy?
Right.
Because, and also the diabolical nature of, so the homes fall apart, so do they want them for the property or just what has been going, it's just so diabolical and so insane calculatingly take people's homes away leave them to sit. It just makes the top of my head
blow. Without that, you don't have the stick, right? So we have the system that insists that we have to participate in this hamster wheel of the system, right? And if we don't have the threat of houselessness and starvation nipping at our heels, what keeps us actually
About the woman who wanted to pay? And then they wouldn't, and there was no sort of grace or anything to any switch around of circumstances or just, because you want to pay. Yeah, because that's what we want. That's being a good citizen to pay, right? We'll help you, da da da. No, we'll just take the house away.
Right, so there's, one of the key elements about capital here. And for example, so with an empty house, it's going to fall apart. It's going to do all those things. It's going to be worth a lot less value. Usually the bank has other houses on the block. It's going to drop the property values. In the interest of money, it doesn't make sense. They would want someone to move in and take care of the house while it's not being sold. But that's not what it's about. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's not the fundamental point of it. Because if people have the ability to start moving into houses, why do they have to trust this other institution? Why do they even have to deal with them? Why can't they just collectively rise up? And that's always the point. It's never really functionally about just money. It's about a system of power that has to maintain itself and protect itself. You know, all systems, dominant systems of power, have in them the methods to maintain themselves and the desire to maintain themselves. I mean, you know, the state is not going to give up power voluntarily. So the point is there that they will have those kind of self-perpetuating mechanisms. And so what people in these situations have to do is to kind of come together collectively. So, for example, if a community decided that they're not going to move out of this house, this block is a no-go zone, a bank doesn't want to touch them because the fight is going to be less in their interest at that point. They're going to be, you know, look like this big bully, which they are, that's forcing people out of their houses.
And we have some callers, but after that, let's get to, speaking of that, Argentina, where things like that really happened. So in a large scale.
Yeah, there's so much to discuss, but let's go ahead. I want to remind folks again to follow us on Facebook, where you can find us as Positively Revolting. You can email us, positivelyrevolting@gmail.com, and you can, in fact, call 503-231-8187. This is Positively Revolting. You are listening to KBOO, your community radio station, where I'm Ani.
I'm Lynn.
And we're here with Shane this morning. And let's go ahead and take Mitch's call right now. Good morning, Mitch. You're on the air.
Hi, this is a much-needed conversation. And hearing Shane begin to speak about institutions and their problems made me realize that sometimes when anarchism is discussed, it fades off into abstractions because I remember in high school, I don't think any course, not social studies, not civics, certainly not history, ever pointed out that anarchy is the antonym, the opposite of hierarchy. And so when it comes to building social movements, you're already at an incredible disadvantage if you don't have hierarchy because you can't do institution building, or you can, but if you look at things, collectivist movements that have attempted to reproduce themselves, like the kibbutz movement in Israel, it has a lot of difficulty making it to the second generation, because hierarchy just has an advantage, a built-in natural advantage in reproducing itself via institution building. And maybe you can address in your conversation how we can compensate for that structural disadvantage, because we don't want necessarily hierarchy, but institutions do. And if you don't have institutions, you can't reproduce your movement.
All right. Thanks very much for your
Shane
comment.
Shane is nodding his head as we speak.
There is a response to that. And one thing is that I want to key in that he said was they have a natural advantage. I guess the question comes is where the evidence any part of this is natural. I guess I want to quote a buddy, Derek Shannon. He used to say in presentations, he'd be like, when people are talking about, well, this is, you know, this stuff is this the stuff, you know, capitalism, state, these things, they're not optimum, but you know, it is, you know, that other stuff you're talking about, that just doesn't work. You know, that's not really natural. And there's two answers for it. The first is it is. Working. It's working all over the place right now, and it has in the past, you know, for, you know, the 100,000 years or so that human beings have been on the planet, 90% of it has been in egalitarian societies where people cooperate and do all these things. Likewise, communities all around you actually exist this way, and they do it very successfully. You know, friendships are founded on this. Societies all over the world, though maybe not in, you know, most industrialized commercial societies, but the point is that there's no reason that it couldn't work in them. And the second thing is to say that these things are natural, or is to say that they work in some way. And there's no way to look outside right now and say that this is working. You know, as the environment is collapsing around us, as Fair working enough. People can barely live, there's no sense that this is working. So the alternative to that would be that something new needs to be presented. And in that, he is right, though. There is one thing that's really right, is that maybe while the hierarchy isn't natural, it is normal. And so people know how to function within hierarchical systems, and they're very effective at what they do.
It's part of the reptilian brain. That's how I always look at it. The reptilian brain tends to be pretty hierarchical, but if we start using the rest of our noggin, cooperation seems to work better. Do you think size has something to do with it, too, that we have more people than we ever have, and that that's one thing about getting things back to being local? But you have to – it has to, doesn't it, be pretty hierarchical to make such a huge behemoth of a thing, of a huge country like this, just be centralized?
I don't know if it has to shrink scale. I think I guess actually this might be a good segue into talking about Argentina.
Yeah, well, yeah. Let's go.
So one of the things that Colin talks about is experience in Argentina, and he went down there to learn from the factory recuperation movement, where workers were not just striking and organizing the workplace, but they were literally booting out the bosses and taking over and starting it up over again.
And didn't Argentina also just say no to the World Bank, as I recall?
IMF.
I believe so.
IMF, yeah, mm-hmm. Rather.
So, you know, he wanted to go down and look at these movements, and, you know, he was considered himself an anarchist, but didn't really like anarchists, and seems to be a story I hear all the time. And
I'm that way about Jung.
What?
I'm that way about Jung. I like Jung, but I'm not too well about Jungians.
So he goes out there and he meets folks from the Red Libertalia, which is an anarchist organization there that's functionally very, very large. I think locals of 150 people and stuff at times, all working directly democratic and not – crowds of, you know, not crowds of students. They weren't just crowds of, you know, they weren't, you know, permaculture folks. They weren't people from a counterculture. These were mainstream working class people.
These were all across the society.
That were working in hotels that then took over the hotels. People that are factory workers took over the factory. Transit workers that took over the buses, that kind of thing. And so that was a kind of inspiration for what he wanted to come back and try and do there. And I'd like to note, too, that this is kind of, you know, this is definitely Colin's inspiration. It's something that other ones of us look to, but it's not necessarily universal through all of us. We didn't, you know. But this idea was what they call the specifismo, which is essentially three things. It's one, the anarchists should have their own organization. It's that organization should find some degree of unity amongst tactics and ideas. And the other one is that it should engage in popular social movements. It shouldn't just segregate itself off and be the most radical on its own, but it should actually engage where movements happen and try and inject ideas that way. Mm-hmm. So it came back with that idea and then helped to form Buffalo Class Action in Buffalo, New York, and then Rochester Red and Black in Rochester, New York. And I was living in Rochester at the time. So that kind of was the seed of it. And I think when he talks about anarchist organization, that's definitely the model he talks about. And within that, it's ends up being so functionally different than the way that anarchists have thought about organizing in the past because, well, first off, it's exclusionary in some ways. Mm-hmm. It's saying that these are – and I don't think that's it's not necessarily a bad idea. It's just saying that these are things that are compatible, you know. So, for example, if you're there talking about, well, we need to organize against, you know, issues of capitalist inequality and someone on the other end is saying, well, no, it's just industrial civilization. That's got to go. You're not reaching enough common point to have like an ideological organization. And at the same point, it's about really engaging in the community, really trying to empower movements and not kind of vanguard them in the way that many Marxist organizations have in the past, in a really disingenuous kind of way. So it's about kind of engaging that way. And within that, you know, there's a whole range of, you know, people's kind of ideas about how that works.
I have to say, I traveled to Argentina 2 years ago, exactly. Mm-hmm. And while I was there, there was a little political upheaval. I know it's so uncommon. And what I was so encouraged to see, there was land rights workers in the province next to Buenos Aires, in the Huehue province, and they had had a conflict with the police. I think this was the first day I got there, and I was there for about 3 weeks. So the first day I got there, conflict with the police, four land rights workers were killed. And then following this on their mainstream 24-hour news channel, where I hear words like their announcers saying that the land rights workers were murdered by the police. And I mean, so starting there, I'm just kind of blown away by the difference in the background, because this is, of course, a very commercial 24-hour news broadcast channel. There is nothing radically alternative about it. This is what you get. And so just seeing the way that it's covered, seeing them being critical of the police, seeing that the governor in that state was immediately apologizing and talking about, you know, what they're going to do with the police who were involved in the incident. And somebody steps down immediately in disgrace. And first of all, okay, I'm just like, wow, this is a whole different way to handle this thing. And then right about the last week I was there, so it took about 2 weeks to build this momentum. But there was a march going through Buenos Aires to you know, demand justice and demand land rights and demand a lack of police murdering people, period. And it was thousands of people. I stopped even trying to give an estimate after I stood on the corner for I don't know how long and watched. I don't even know, like for a long time, four lanes of people walking by me. And, you know, all of these clusters, the you know, Marxists for this and that, the trade unionists of the whatnot, and then all of these anarchists and different anarchist groups that were, you know, all together under these banners. There was a group of probably over 200 people with red and white flags that were all under one particular anarchist organization. And they were age diverse and gender diverse and very obviously not of a fringe part of society. And I stood on the corner and wept. I mean, this is like 2 months before Occupy happened. So it was, in fact, the first time that I've ever seen probably more than 10 anarchists standing together. You know? And mm-hmm. And I was so incredibly touched that and ended up trying to. My Spanish has improved a lot in the last 2 years, but it was really super bad then. But, you know, we spent a good part of the afternoon attempting to dialogue and talk about organizing. So I'm thrilled that is part of this conversation, because to me, looking at things internationally is huge. It's really important. There's a criticism that, you know, all this sort of radical politics stuff is of the rich white kids that are in school in the States, and it doesn't really have any bearing on the rest of the world. Nothing could be further from the truth in my experience. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I just want to share that anecdote. I also want to let, there is, let's see, somebody else on the line.
Mike is on the line.
It's Mike. All right. Good morning, Mike. Good morning. Are you there?
Good morning.
Hi.
Good morning. You're on the air.
I recommend a book and author to the cause here.
We love books. Go ahead.
Great. There's a whole series of books by Stephen Johnson.
Okay.
And The one in front of me now is The Ghost Map, Story of London's Most Terrifying Epidemic and How It Changed Science, Cities, and the Modern World. And it really does demonstrate how chaos is just a part of all civilization, and it's the fringes that really teach us the most. And anarchy is part of that. There's always going to be some hierarchy, but the anarchy aspect of it is the equivalent of people finding use out of the waste of others, you know. And there's dangers in that, but there's also great things to learn. And whether hierarchical or not, we can all learn from those experiences. So it's not just being in the streets. It's just the daily grind that we learn from. And keep it local. And also, Chris Hedges, anything by Chris Hedges. There's a three-hour interview on C-SPAN 2 in 2012. Mm-hmm. Go to C-SPAN 2 online or whatever, or get an audio of it. Of Chris Hedges is a special three-hour interview of him.
Hey, I wanna...
you're not going to find that anywhere else. Thank you.
Great, Mike. Thanks very much for calling in with some resources. That's great. I want to let you know that you can still call in and join in this discussion on revolutionary anarchy and anarchism and anarchists and organizing, all that kind of stuff. 8:44 in the morning. The phone number to call is 503-231-8187. You can also Facebook us. I'm now turning that into a verb. Okay. You can Facebook us where you can find us as...
I believe it is a verb these days.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, we don't even want to start with Googling. So that's Facebook. We are Positively Revolting, where you can also find us at Gmail, positivelyrevolting@gmail.com. I want to also mention that Joe, who works with the Old Mole Collective here at KABU, will also... I'll be looking at the Revolutionary Anarchism event that is coming up and the discussion surrounding it. He says that the Old Mole Variety Hour for the next two Monday mornings, so Monday morning, 9 to 10 o'clock, is the Old Mole Variety Hour. For the next 2 weeks, they will be looking at revolutionary anarchism and looking to get Colin on himself on the 12th, talking with a new member of the Old Mole Collective. So... there will be more to come on this topic here on KABU, your very own community radio station. Looks like on the 5th, there's going to be a conversation around especifismo, that thing that you were just talking about. In my Spanish, I said it's improving. I didn't say it's good. and also... looking at the event and scholarly sort of topics there. So that's coming up on the 5th and the 12th, 9 o'clock, here on your community radio station, 503-231-8187, the number to call if you'd like to jump in right now. I'm going to jump in right now. So there's always this sort of snicker, I suppose, that goes on when people talk about anarchist organizing. And I don't want the show to go by without us actually addressing that. So many people, and again, this is one of those reasons I wanted to start out with definitions, because to me, these are not at all dissimilar. This is how we do things. but to so many people, the idea of an anarchist organization is oxymoronic. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about what anarchist organizing looks like to you?
Well, also because our last caller a little bit sounded like he was equating anarchism with chaos. And of course,
right.
I don't think you see it that way. I certainly don't.
Well, so I mean, it's functionally the opposite of that in a lot of ways, because the idea would be that to equate it with chaos would be a really good argument for having the state, saying that right. people are inherently kind of chaotic and that without some kind of thing parenting them, that they'll be running around and with you know, complete disorder in some ways.
Running
and,
around in their underwear with
yeah,
their
I mean,
empire,
like,
yeah.
It would just be just maddening.
Like that, Lynn.
But the point being is that people do have innate forms of organizing. They collectivize things. They take care of each other. They do these things all the time. And so anarchism is essentially trying to find a new way of having those organizations, redefining them and having, like we said, non-hierarchical social organization. So when it comes to actually organizing, when it has to having an organization, It is just like it sounds. It's developing structures that work under those principles. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, having an organization that explicitly opposes all these intersecting forms of oppression. Mm-hmm. It's about having an organization where people can kind of grow and achieve and have solidarity, create mutual aid and that kind of thing.
And a lot of meetings.
And my maddening number of meetings. Though I'd like to say that having an ideological organization has kind of lowered the meeting number a little bit. So in Rochester Red and Black, we only had general meetings once a month because it's just too aggravating to do. And the idea is that we come together and make those decisions, but we work on stuff the rest of the time. We're going in meetings other places, and we're getting together and doing practical work. And so sitting around in 3-hour meetings
I poo-poo meetings just because I go to a lot of them. But it's really – I think of older cultures, and I was listening to a Native American show that we had on last night, and that's how people get mm-hmm. together. And we have become so dependent on being voyeurs or just slamming something down on the sand way too fast that we forget about when you are face to face. It's very important for us to be face to face and be able to know how to communicate with each other in a respectful manner.
I mean, our lives don't really allow for it. When mm-hmm. you're at a workplace 8 hours a day, you have all the other maintenance you have to do just to be there, families, friends. I mean, it's a difficult to then pile 3-hour meetings on top, but it just really is. And what it does is it alienates people who are engaged in kind of their daily struggles, mm-hmm. the struggles of the workplace, the struggles against, obviously intersecting oppressions. So what it does is allows just the people that can have the time to do that, which are like students, which are like, people that are engaged in kind of counterculture work, which is fine, but it doesn't allow for the diversity to have a movement really of the people, to have a truly democratic movement that reflects the people of the community and actually has the ability and wherewithal to actually change things.
Right. Which is, in different times, different places, looking at exactly that issue has brought movements into the ideas that for all meetings, we must provide childcare. For all meetings, we must provide food. For all meetings, we must provide, all of these things that can help to equalize the voices heard during those. Right. Those gatherings. And I think if we start looking at things in terms of their gatherings, they're where we come together, they're where we get that bonding and understanding of each other, where we can look each other in the eye and get some trust built, that they will go much better than if we think, oh my God, I've got another freaking meeting this week, which just, who likes that besides me and a small handful of others? I mean, I love meetings. I do.
It's unbelievable, but it's true.
It's true. That's why I'm a facilitator. Okay, so I want to let folks know, coming right up on KABU at 9 o'clock today, we will be remembering very fondly a founding collective member of APA Compass. APA Compass will be airing at 9 o'clock, and a portion of their show will be remembering Afifa Ahmed Shafi, who died suddenly early this week. She was an early member of the APA Collective. They will also be introducing a new segment called Heart to Heart with Ka. We also will be reporting, and when I say we, I mean the APA Compass, will be reporting on how both new and traditional media misidentified a missing Brown University student as the Boston Marathon bombing suspect. Also looking at racist hoaxes following the crash of Asiana Flight 214 and an interview with Jean Kroc about her novel Girl in Translation. That's all coming up between 9 and 10 o'clock. They pack that show. At 10 o'clock, Flashpoints devotes an entire hour to the work of Pulitzer Prize winning writer Alice Walker, including a talk that she gave this week on her life and work. At 11 o'clock, Shahid Hamid hosts a special interview with Colin with Reverend Dr. Leroy Haynes Jr. of the Albina Ministerial Alliance Coalition for Justice and Police Reform on police accountability. The recent Supreme Court decision on Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act and plans for the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. Thanks to all you KABU members for your generous support. You are, in fact, how we stay on the air. If you are not a member, you can go ahead and take care of that right now by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. So there. All that coming right up, and oh so much more. We have a caller waiting to jump in,
yes, we do.
From what I understand.
John.
Hi. I'd like to put the question to the audience. In what year was there a 33% increase in the minimum wage? That's all.
Wait. You have to wait. Do you know the answer?
Yes.
Well, hold on. Because we're all looking.
I want to know more to the point. Why? What is your point?
Oh wait, that's right. I have.
We can all Google, but I just want to hear from John because we're not going to have the chance to talk to him again real soon. John, why?
The point is that they're so piddly about the wage increases that. This was a minimum wage story that was terrific, and the country went on. We didn't go down in flames or anything, but it was a 33% increase. Okay.
All right. Very cool. Bye. Thanks. Thanks for that, John. And with that, we have just about 5 minutes left, so let's go ahead and talk for a moment about the event coming up on the 13th. Want to make sure that everyone knows about it. So go ahead, more details there.
So on the 13th, it'll be at the Red and Black Cafe at 7 o'clock, and Colin will be talking about the idea of anarchist-specific organizations, what it means, what it could look like. Some of his ideas about it, and then having a discussion to hear, really flesh out the idea of what organized anarchism look like. And there's a lot of various ways that can happen. You know, people talk about federations and confederations and all these different things, and all those are really important ideas to kind of throw around. And then I think we'll also be discussing a project that a number of other organizations have been a part of called the In Our Hearts Network. It's becoming kind of a more formalized federation of different groups that have already existed. They're called Class Struggle Anarchist Groups and are kind of coming together to form a larger, more permanent structure. And so I'll be talking a little bit about that and what it's looked like and that kind of thing.
That sounds like a lot of fun. It sounds like a really good discussion time. 7 o'clock at the Red and Black, and the Red and Black is located at 12th and Southeast Oak. If you don't know, that is the Collective Cafe, Vegan Cafe. So, again, on Tuesday the 13th, just over a week, 7 p.m. at the Red and Black. If you, like myself, cannot get enough of this topic, I think this sort of dialogue is really the only way to move it forward. This sort of conversation and learning from each other, and also learning from international examples. I'm just completely over the moon about Colin having the experience in Argentina. So I can't wait to hear more about that section.
Right. And it's really important. I mean, the idea of discussing it, taking chances, making mistakes, and finding organizations that have the ability to continue working in the community and not alienating from it is really important. And so, taking on those projects and talking about them and being open about it is really, really important to this process.
And not alienating the community and not becoming vanguardist. Those mm-hmm. are principles mm-hmm. that you have mentioned several times during this last hour. And I think that those are principles that we cannot emphasize enough. Because, in fact, we are the people. We are the community. And, we want to be supportive overall and not necessarily, be the kids that are the coolest and most radical on the block. And in that way, there's already this separation and it leads to oppressive behaviors, frankly.
Right.
Yeah. So I'm thrilled that is part of the focus for the discussion. Shane, thank you so very much for being with us this morning.
Thank you for having me on. It's been a lot of fun.
It is.
The hour always goes too quickly by. If you have, we have about 1 minute left. If you have anything left to add, please do go right ahead. We can think about it for a second. As I say, next week, Lynn will be sojourning once again. This is Lynn's year of travel.
It is.
And so you won't have her to kick around next week, but I'll be back with you. Any last words, Shane?
Excited to see people come out to the event. And it's a great way, if you haven't been involved before, to discuss what it might be, what you might want to participate in and see what's kind of out there and available.
Excellent. I'm going. I wouldn't miss it. I think it's going to be just a great night for a good discussion and really coming together and meeting each other and, getting off of Facebook and other tools of networking to actually do it the old-fashioned way, we call it. Yeah. Okay. Thank you so much for joining us, Shane. Mm-hmm. Do stay tuned to KBOO, your community radio station, at 9 o'clock. The APA Compass will be on, and as we have said, an action-packed show with remembering Afifa Ahmed Shafi. And also, I wanted to say happy Lammas to everyone. Good Lunasa. This is that six-week turning of the wheel thing that I do like to note every time it happens. This is the Feast of First Harvest for those of us that are more paganly inclined. So go out and enjoy the first harvest. Think about those things that you're bringing into your life and make see how that integrates and what you are, in fact, being able to get back to yourself now. Thanks very much. We'll be back. I'll be back next week.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Tune in to Plugged In every first and third Fridays from 10 p.m. to midnight with host DJ Tronic. Tronic does a live mix in the studio featuring the latest in house, techno, tech house, breaks, dubstep, and more. Tronic also has guest DJs in the studio and often talks about upcoming parties, club nights, and more. That's Plugged In every first and third Fridays at 10 p.m. only on KBOO Portland.
Pickathon.